Chairman Stephen Mayne, shareholder. I should tell the meeting that the stock's up $1.85 to 20.65 at the moment. So obviously congratulations on the terrific profit upgrade announcement. 35% EPS growth versus the previous forecast of 20%. I guess my question in part ties into that is to where is it all coming from? I noticed that the principal investment profit share was up from about 35% to about 45%. So obviously we're buying more assets, we're taking on a bit more risk. Can you tell us a bit more about where the profit growth is going to come from in 06, this amazing 35% growth figure? Are we seeing an increasing trend in the principal investments? And could you also, when answering this one, just comment on how important the Aircom deal is in the profit upgrade? I mean, obviously, an $8 billion takeover, I assume we're doing the corporate advisory work, maybe some debt funding. So how important is Aircom in that profit upgrade forecast? Thanks.
A few parts to the question. Steve, I'll try and remember them all. Taking the last part first, while we don't comment on specific transactions, what we can say is that looking at our current expectations and pipeline, that we do expect to be able to say at the end of 2006 that no single transaction will have contributed more than 5% of our revenue. In terms of a detailed mix, we don't see the mix changing a lot in our earnings. What we can say is that the rate of growth in our recurring fee income from managing assets is higher than the rest of the business. That said, it doesn't change some of the other percentages materially if our management fee income rises from 10 to say 15% of our total revenue, across the other sources of our income, that doesn't have, you know, a huge effect. But growth is coming from leveraging our balance sheet, certainly applying more capital, transactions. We are doing more transactions. Some of those transactions are getting larger in size. Growth is coming from the strong development pipeline that we have in the energy sector, the creation of new funds, and we have a number of initiatives that alluded to in my presentation. All of these things have significant momentum at the moment and are delivering a strong growth. Obviously, market conditions, some significant international event, all of those things could impact us the same as they would impact other businesses. But at the moment, the momentum is extremely strong. The opportunities that are coming our way are significant. The foundations that we alluded to last year that were being laid for 2006 are certainly coming to fruition.
In the absence of anyone else, Chairman, come up from Melbourne, so I may as well ask a couple.
You're sitting in the front of the room this year, too. It's good.
Yeah,
I can actually see what you look like.
I didn't get in early enough. The various investments in the satellite funds at December 31 were valued at, I think it was about $400 million. Can you tell us where we're at with those vis-a-vis market values at the moment? Like, I know that Macquarie will often come out and say we're currently, you know, $500 million up on our various investments in our funds. How are we going across, the various breakdowns on page 58 of the annual report, which lay out the percentage stakes in all the different funds?
I can't give you an exact number. We'll publish that table with our half-yearly results in August. But I think we can safely assume that across our entire portfolio, the market value of our holdings in the funds has increased, and I'd be reasonably confident not only has the market value of our total investment increased, so has our total investment as we've created new funds, but also that the unrealised or that the gap between the book value and the market value has also increased favourably.
Okay, I'll go again. Please, it'd be good if someone else could ask a question. We only get one chance a year, so... just a question on a lot of our revenues coming from, obviously, the various satellite funds, and I ask this one at Macquarie every year as well. It's the risk of being removed as manager, that somehow someone will come along, a bit like we did to Lendlease, and run some sort of campaign or program to remove us as manager of, you know, wind, environment, capital, infrastructure, etc. How secure do you think we are in terms of our long-term management rights in the various funds? Because it is, I guess, a part of the risk that anyone takes buying shares in Babcock and Brown. I mean, I'm a shareholder in three of the satellites. I sit there and look at some of the large fees, and wearing those hats, I sometimes say, you know, geez, they take another $17.5 million out of wind. If I was a big shareholder, I'd be minded to do something about it. So the question is, how secure are we from someone coming along and trying to do that to us and removing one of our very lucrative fee income streams?
What answer did Alan Moss give to this question?
David Clark says that anyone can sack us any time. We rely on our performance.
That sounds like a good answer. I think what I would say is along those lines, that the greatest security that I think we have in any of our funds will be the quantum of performance fees that we achieve. If we're getting substantial performance fees, that means that the fund investors are getting significant outperformance compared with comparative investments. And in that world, it's very rare that people get dissatisfied with management, whether it be internal or external. And I think while you, Stephen, may be one of those people that looks at their investment based on how much other people are getting, I think the majority of investors actually look at their investment based on how much they're getting. And if they're doing really well, they're usually very happy. And I think that if we can keep up performance, and as we showed on that table earlier, that performance, in absolute performance since listing of all our funds, with the clear exception at this point of Babcock and Brown Capital, but we do have a view that the Aircom deal is a very attractive transaction for Babcock and Brown Capital investors. While we can maintain that sort of performance, while we stick to our policy of not recommending acquisitions to the funds that we don't believe are accretive, that we stick to our policy of when we do raise capital, we raise it for accretive investments, and to date, we have never raised capital in one of our funds at a price below which the capital had been previously raised. And we expect that particular position to continue as well. So as long as we can keep up that performance for the fund investors, we co-invest in those funds. We have significant investment in the funds. A lot of us at this table have significant investment in those funds, and a lot of the executives that are out on the floor or otherwise working on transactions around the world also have significant of their own money in those funds.
Okay, I'll just have one last go. I'll ask three at once this time and then I'll be done. First one is, I noticed that Phil, you and I think it's Peter Hofbauer have spent $9.6 million buying shares in BBI, Babcock and Brown Infrastructure, which has underperformed in the last 3 months. Why was that, you know, why did the executives do it as opposed to the bank? I mean, I often sort of look at the whole Babcock structure and you sort of, why is, you know, when the first Aircom share raid happened, why did we put $51 million in and Capital put $300 million in, and then we sold $30 million of ours. And sometimes I just can't follow who's doing what and why. So I'd like it, you know, some insight on this one. Why did you and Peter feel that you had to put $9.8 million into infrastructure as opposed to the bank itself, which already, I guess, had a 7% exposure worth about $100 million? My other one is, what are you doing with Alinta? There's all this press speculation that you're creeping up on them. You bought 3%, and you know who's doing it? Is it DBI? Is it you guys? Is it you personally, Phil? What's, you know? And can you tell us a bit about our relationship with UBS? I mean, we did the float in October 2004. UBS was our advisor. They said, you know, $5 a share is a good float price. So you massively diluted everyone who was already in the stock, given the shares are now obviously well north of 20. And we're north of 8 on the day it floated. Interesting to see that they took 3% of the shares in that offering at that knockdown price, and then they were first of the exits in March when you had the opportunity for your staff to sell. So, you know, if I put a cynical hat on, I say UBS advise on a low share price, scoop up 3% and then take a fast buck on the way out. So, I mean, what do you think of the way they've behaved, and what's the relationship with UBS going forward?
Well,
maybe for your next meeting you should fly to Geneva and go to the UBS AGM and ask them. Well, I've forgotten the first two questions now. Why did Peter and I invest in BBI? Well, the simple answer is at Babcock and Brown, we have a very clear employee investment policy, which makes it very clear that, so this goes to your Linter question, makes it very clear that corporate opportunities, that anything comes to Babcock and Brown is a Babcock and Brown investment, and employees don't get those opportunities to invest in those transactions. Where we have listed funds, where we widely distribute investment products, then employees are free to invest in those alongside and at the same price as the public. Generally, we have a compliance procedure that we go through in those situations, but a lot of investors are comforted by the fact that our employees are putting their own money in at the same price. BBI is a listed stock. Trading window is open. And employees are free to buy it. The company itself has a significant weighting in BBI. It participated in the last capital raising on a full pro rata basis. Some employees, including myself and Peter, believe strongly that that stock is undervalued. No doubt you'll have some questions in relation to remuneration. We were well remunerated last year, and we need to put our money somewhere, and BBI looks better than most places to us. As far as Alinta is concerned, we certainly don't comment on press speculation and any transactions that may be ongoing. Obviously, it is a matter of record that Alinta have chosen to make public that we are on their register. I don't wish to comment any further. As far as UBS is concerned, I'd just like to correct one thing. UBS did not participate in the initial capital raising at $5. They actually bought shares of HVB at a premium to that price. When they bought them, they agreed to a voluntary escrow period. It expired. And I suppose the other thing I correct is that they actually traded out to the extent they have sold down. That trading occurred after the employee build and actually after HVB had sold down a stake. So in terms of them being first to the door, I suppose they weren't. We have a good relationship with UBS. We have a good relationship with other global investment banks. We work closely with a lot of them. We have a number of funds that raise capital. We hope that relationship continues long into the future.
Look, in the absence of anyone else, I'd be interested in perhaps even hearing from the auditor on this one. It's to do with the issue of valuation of options. If you look at page 75 of this year's annual report, and I'll take Phil Green's pay package as an example, it says that he received $10.3 million in 2004. So he's only had a modest increase to $12.2 million in 2005. But the problem with the $10.3 million figure that you've served up again in this year's annual report is that when Phil was issued 800,000 options the day before the float, they were only priced at $5 a share. Yet you've only valued them in this annual report and in the last annual report at $1.27 a share. So that means that as part of his incentive payments, you've included a figure of just over $1 million. Now, the actual reality of the situation today is that those 800,000 free shares are $15.65 up, and the profit that Phil's made is actually about $11 or $12 million. And so an accurate assessment of what Phil got in 2004 is actually about $21 or $22 million, not $10.3 million. Now, this is a problem right across the public company sector, particularly in a buoyant market. I don't know, because the accounting standards say you've got to value them at the day of issue, et cetera, et cetera. But I suspect a lot of companies take a very, very conservative view on that. And I think the Babcock view is probably perhaps the most conservative of all. In other words, you valued them at $1 million, or just over, when you knew the share price at the time, when you were preparing last year's annual report and this year's annual report, was that it was actually, you know, 5, 10, and now it's up to about 12 million. So my question is, you know, basically, do you accept that this remuneration report, as it relates to Phil's pay in 2004, is actually inaccurate, and the actual real amount of remuneration that he's received as we look at it today is 21 to 22 million, not 10.3 million? And if you accept that point, perhaps we can actually then tackle the issue of the accounting standards and the fact that companies right across the board are producing annual reports which, on my estimations, underestimate executive pay in the top 100 stocks by between half a billion and $1 billion. And the Babcock contribution to that is sort of, you know, 20, 30, 40 million, depending how you measure it.
Well, you know, as you rightly identify, Stephen, this is an accounting standards issue. And I guess, you know, depending on the day when you apply the accounting standards and depending what the market's doing on the day, you know, what comes out at the end of that calculation will differ. So I'm not quite sure that it's helpful for us to have a debate about the application of the accounting standards. I'm happy. I know our auditor's sitting there and he's smiling away, and I'm sure he'd be very happy to respond, you know, on that issue. But we're really in the hands of our auditors as in so far as, you know, the way in which we put this report together. And, you know, we've done it in line with the accounting standards. As you say, we've done it in line with what every other listed company does, and I suspect, you know, if you have an issue with the accounting standards, well, you know, it's the accounting standards board probably that you should be taking this question up with.
Just one more on this one. Corporate Governance International had a bit of a go at you in their report, according to what I read in the Fin Review, saying that 4 years isn't long enough in terms of the deferred rights, and they compare that with Macquarie, which leaves the money on the table for a rolling 10-year period. And I often go to the Macquarie AGM and say, why don't half your blokes just retire? Because they're worth, you know, 50, 100 million, whatever. And they always say, well, it's because we make them hang on for 10 years. And that's the secret to our success. So I guess my question would be, I'm not so upset about the 50-50 split. The share price is going up, seems to be working well. That's great. But why not go closer to the Macquarie model of leaving it on the table for maybe 6 or 7 years? And why not put a slightly higher proportion of the bonuses into that? So rather than 25 or 30% of scrip for 4 years, if you went 40% of the bonus is scrip and you locked it up for 6 years, it would be a nod to those that are, you know, barking a bit about your remuneration policies, and it would get you a bit closer to Macquarie. So is that just a policy, or just a board policy decision? Why don't you just, you know, acknowledge that point and move it a bit that way?
Let me try to answer that, and I'll see if Ian may also want to answer it. I mean, the first thing is we don't benchmark ourselves in our remuneration policies against Macquarie. We do what we think's right for our shareholders and our employees. And if they happen to coincide, that's fine, but, I mean, that's not, it's not our starting point. So the second point to make is that if you look at our employees and you look at the level of equity investment that our employees have in this company, it is far higher. I mean, I don't know what the percentage is, but there's a much, much higher percentage overall of investment by our employees in this company than there is in Macquarie. The third thing is that there's an issue of fairness here. I mean, I'm sure there are many people out in the audience here who, you know, either now or in the past have got bonuses. And what we're really saying to people is, look, you've met all your performance hurdles. You're entitled to the cash. But now we're going to take 35% off you and lock it up for 4 years. And by the way, if you don't stay, we're going to take it away entirely. So, you know, we have a very strong alignment and motivation with our employees. We try to strengthen that. But I think there's an issue of reasonableness. And our judgment is that holding on to that for 4 years is fair enough, particularly given that the next year there'll be another bonus, and, you know, and that gets extended for 4 years, and the next year after that there's another bonus and part of that is extended for 4 years. So they've always got some skin in the game that way.
Isn't that the point?
Can I just let Ian may want to say something further?
Indeed I do. Just in relation to the percentage, Stephen, you said why not increase it. In fact, for people over a certain level, we did increase it. For some very senior executives, we actually increased that figure from 25% to a larger figure than that, having regard to the quantum, essentially the quantum that they were being paid. So we have exercised some flexibility. I guess with respect to the 4 years, once again, I'd sort of emphasise the point. We did go through an extensive benchmarking exercise. We did conclude that 4 years was fair and reasonable given, as Elizabeth said, the level of equity ownership that already exists in this firm, but also given the fact that we are effectively handcuffing what could have otherwise been and in some organisations is paid in cash.
And the only question I get is the biggest risk for our shareholders is that, you know, if Phil wakes up tomorrow and says, well, BRW says I'm worth $350 million, I'm going to retire. Or other executives do that. Now, it's a remuneration policy question here as to whether you give them the deferred bonuses. So let's just paint that scenario. If Phil wakes up tomorrow and says I've had enough, I'm going to retire, is that just a matter for the remuneration policy to say, oh, okay, Phil, you can have the $10 million which is sitting there because you're going to retire? I mean, how strong is the lock on the handcuffs is my point, I guess. Is with Macquarie, they say 10 years, it's very strong, that's why they never leave. Whereas here...
That's not true. That's not true, Stephen. Macquarie pay that out to retirees. It is actually a non-compete handcuff. It's not anything that prevents retirement or discourages retirement. So let's just get the facts right.
All right, so that's my point, is that the senior team can retire tomorrow and they'll all get all their deferred bonuses. Is that the actual policy you're telling me here? As long as they don't compete, they get the lot. So we're going through this process of locking them up, but it doesn't actually keep them working. It just stops them from competing. Is that the effect of the policy?
Well, look, you know, with all due respect, Stephen, I mean, given the way our share price at the moment is, if Phil decided to stop work tomorrow, I don't think the fact that we said, I mean, you can't have your 35% of this year's bonus is going to stop him, you know. I mean, he's got more than enough in any event. So, you know, let's be real here. I mean, this is not an issue relating to Phil and Jim and the people around this table who were partners in the original business, who worked for many years to build the business up. And, you know, and have substantial equity in this business. What this scheme really is about and where it's effective is in relation to younger executives coming up in the business who don't have that level of equity, and in respect of which it's important that we do try and motivate them to stay. So a debate about whether Phil might leave, I think, really is a bit misleading. For a young executive, if he's likely to leave, it's much more likely he's going to go to a competitor, and that's the whole point of having the policy, to sort of keep him there for longer.
Those proxy votes are interesting, Acting Chair. There's only 3.4 million against the remuneration report, yet 12 million against James Fantacci, despite his wonderful contribution over the years. So I think the takeout from that is that your big institutional shareholders are more concerned about having a majority of independent directors than they are about your pay levels. Because if you took out the board table and senior management chairs, that's actually quite a large protest vote against James. But my question for Michael, and I'm expecting that his against vote will be the normal 1% or less, given that he is a genuine independent. My question for Michael is that one of the debates that happens around Babcock is this whole question of the management, the how secure the management contracts are on the various satellite funds and how easy it is to give Babcock the punt if a bunch of institutional shareholders wanted to get in there and have a go. And there's a bit of a debate also about the level of disclosure about any termination arrangements or, you know, the fine detail of ending the management arrangement. So as a director of the ASX, my question to Michael is whether he's had any discussions, is he involved in that issue from a board level about how much we disclose on the management and termination? And is he comfortable with the level of disclosure in all of the listed Australian Stock Exchange funds about the security of the management contract and any termination arrangements that do apply?
Well, look, I'll let Michael answer that, but just before I do, can I make the point that in relation to each of these funds, each fund has its own board, and on each of those boards are highly qualified independent directors who have a responsibility for the accounts of those funds and for the disclosure of those funds. So, you know, we're not talking here about a bunch of satellite funds which are sort of down in the bowels of Babcock and Brown management and not adequately oversighted. These are listed funds. They all comply individually with the requirements of the stock exchange, with the requirements of the accounting standards. They all have independent directors, you know, who are highly qualified and responsible people. And it's against that background that Babcock and Brown allows its name to be used on those funds. So I think it's just important to set your question in some context, Stephen. But, Michael, if you'd like to sort of say something, please feel free.
Stephen, the answer is I am satisfied. The answer is I'm extremely interested in it. I think it goes to our reputation. I think our transparency in this is of a high standard.
Chairman, I have to say, in the broad scheme of things, this is just a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's actually not a particularly big issue. He's paying $17.25 a pop versus all those $5 a pop options day before the float. I'm a bit confused about the fuss, but look, I would like to know when does the clock start ticking? Like, is the $17.25, is that the base price in measuring the performance, or is it the, you know, moving average, etc.?
$17.25.
Right, okay, so he's got a little bit of an advantage on the starting point for the performance hurdles, but look, at least he has got some performance hurdles. So, look, I haven't got any particular problem with this, but I guess what is interesting is that I gather one of the proxy advisory firms, who are the real kingmakers in the current sort of AGM environment, have had a bit of a go at this resolution. So what will be interesting is whether they've got anywhere near knocking it over in terms of what the proxies are. And my question, therefore, is how broad is the exclusion? This is the first resolution where some shareholders are conflicted out and can't vote, and that includes everyone up here on the head table. So it's a bit ambiguous as to whether other senior managers, you know, who might have a million or two shares, can vote. So how broad is the exclusion on this resolution in terms of who can't vote versus what we've seen with the 110 million proxies that we've averaged on the previous resolutions?
Okay. Sorry, I'm just getting my legal advisor here. It's a bit technical. So the people who are excluded are the people on the top table here, plus the trustees of the Babcock and Brown, the trustees of the share trust. So if you're asking, can other executives in the room, other who are not members of the board, vote, the answer is yes, they can vote.
Address. It relates to the valuation of options that I mentioned earlier, and I'd just like to ask him whether he agrees with the following proposition. That notwithstanding the accounting standards, does he agree that the claim in the 2005 annual report, where the audit statement is dated March 30, 2006, the claim that Phil Green's salary package in 2004 was $10.3 million. Does he agree that that's actually a material misstatement and that based on the current share price today or the share price on March 30, 2006, when the audit was signed, the actual correct figure, taking in the true value of the $805 options that he was issued, is approximately $21 million, not the $10.3 million that is in this signed, audited 2005 annual report?
Yes, Mr.
Thank you. Look, the only way I can respond to that is by saying that the accounts are drawn up in accordance with the accounting standards. That is the only requirement we have, and the opinion signed clean based on the accounting standards.